The biggest stories you never heard of in 2009.
We tend to think that covering stories about the powerful is what journalism is supposed to do. It's not left-wing or right-wing or anything. It's just, what are the powerful doing and why are they doing it?
That's Peter Phillips of Project Censored. We talked to him about the project's latest collection of the most underreported important news stories of 2009. It's called Censored 2010.
One of the big questions for me is whether the self is just a personality or a persona, that you can be any number of different people, or whether there is something essential about each individual person that's unchangeable.
And that's novelist Dan Schoen. We talked to him about his thriller, Await Your Reply. It examines the truth and lies about identity. When celebrity scandals and murders dominate the news, the stories that really affect our lives often go unreported. Stories about nuclear waste that could contaminate large swaths of the U.S., voter machine fraud that steals our elections, or how global corporations foster the conditions for piracy in places like Somalia. Between media consolidation and the dominance of news as entertainment, the American media consumer is often left with poor information about why things are the way they are. For the last 34 years, Project Censored has been swimming against the tide of mediocrity, bringing to light the big stories that have been too often ignored by the mainstream. Walter Cronkite called it one of the organizations that we should listen to be assured that our newspapers and our broadcast outlets are practicing thorough and ethical journalism. Based at Sonoma State University in California, the project brings academics and students from 9 campuses together to find, review, and fact-check the stories that media either didn't cover or covered poorly. Out of these, it picks the top 25 each year and publishes them in a book, Censored, The News That Didn't Make the News. I spoke with Project Censored's Peter Phillips in December. I asked him if it was really censorship that kept these stories out of the news.
Oh, yes. But it's not that the word censored, from the Latin censura, you know, it meant government control of the news. No, we have private corporations that are basically cooperating with government in terms of top-down propaganda and news, often done through public relations firms. But there is some level of objectivity attempts historically in journalism in the United States. But as media is consolidated, and we've gone, in the lifetime of our program, we've gone from 50 major media corporations down to 10, there's a great amount of sharing. The news looks principally the same, and these corporations are in the entertainment business. They're aiming to keep us highly entertained, but essentially then we become very poorly informed.
So you actually cover that in one of the later chapters of Project Censored, and I'd like to get back to that point. But first, let's look at some of the stories that are the most underreported stories or the most censored stories in the past year or two, because this actually covers 2008 and 2009 with some updates of 2008.
Well, our cycle is March of each year,
okay.
And March can go either way. So that's our cutoff point, because we want the book to come out each fall so it can be used in classrooms around the country. So the book comes out in late August and is available for college professors to use, and a lot of professors do. So our cycle is this 12-month cycle around the month of March.
So the news today, as we're recording this interview, was that the U.S. Senate began a debate, actually yesterday, on Tuesday, on a $636 billion defense spending bill that a lot of critics say is too laden with special interest projects and other unnecessary measures. And in fact, even our president, President Obama, has said something to that effect. A lot of people think of this whole kind of the idea of pork in the defense spending bill as bringing back the bacon to their districts. But this Project Censored 2010 points out that almost every lawmaker is actually personally invested in war contractors.
Well, not everyone, but about a third of them. Mm-hmm. And a couple hundred million dollars involved. So Yeah, that was pretty amazing to us when we saw that study whereby, you know, a third or so of the members of Congress actually have stock in defense contractors doing business with the United States government. They're actually going to vote on the bills.
Is this a conflict of interest?
Well, apparently not legally in terms, I certainly think it is morally. But the idea that we spend more on defense than the rest of the world combined, that we even have a budget of $600 billion plus the wars on top of that for defense of this country. It's not defense for you and me. This is defense for American capital expansion globally and U.S. corporations worldwide. That's why we have an empire. That's why we have 1,000 military bases all over the world. So, yes, of course this is a conflict of interest. The people in Congress, many of them are multimillionaires, and they're heavily invested in some of the top corporations this Defense Department is designed to protect.
You know, one of our senators here, we produce a show at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Our senator is John Kerry. He's one who's one of the most heavily invested, and yet he's come out against, you know, expanding the war in Afghanistan. He was against the war in Iraq. So is there a necessary one-to-one relationship here, or what do you feel is the real kernel of the story that has been so underreported?
Well, is there a one-to-one relationship if $200 million is invested in defense contractors by 151 members of Congress? That seems pretty one-to-one to me. But to what extent that is reflective of the overall, of Congress's overall desire to support a military, industrial, and I also include media, complex of power, not only in the U.S. but the world, that I think is the more important issue.
And talking about the military, one of the stories in Project Censored 2010 is about Obama's military appointments and having a corrupt past themselves. You know, when Obama came in, he said that he was going to, you know, make sure that that people working in government did not have a lobbyist background. You know, he's going to be make sure that they were pretty squeaky clean in terms of conflicts of interest. However, he made some exceptions, and one of them was William Lynn, who is his deputy defense secretary. Talk about him and his contacts, his relationship to the defense industry.
Well, William Lynn is the former controller under the Clinton administration. He was controlling the Pentagon when close to over $3 trillion went missing. They couldn't account for it. And the Republicans were making a big deal about this in the fall of 2001. Rumsfeld came on national television and saying that we have this problem. We can't find $3 trillion in the account for it inside the Defense Department. And the next day, 9/11 happened, so it kind of just went away, and no one ever talked about it very much again. However, in the interim, William Lynn went to work for Raytheon, which is John Kerry's district up in Massachusetts. Raytheon is one of the top 10 defense contractors in the country. And he was in charge of lobbying. He spent $6 million in 2008 lobbying Congress on behalf of Raytheon. And then he gets placed right back into the position of Deputy Director of Defense. It's quite a rotating door story, very much of what Obama said he was not going to do. But what's interesting and clearly an indication of the Obama administration's continuing support for military defense and expansion is that he's the first president ever in American history to keep an opposing party's Secretary of Defense or War in place. So keeping Robert Gates in place as Secretary of Defense had never been done before in American history.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Peter Phillips of Project Censored. Each year, it publishes the top 25 most censored nationally important news stories in a yearbook, Censored. This year, it's Censored 2010. And you also talk about here one of the top stories, in fact, I think the number three top story, is another way in which, well, here not the military, but the domestic law enforcement, the FBI, is having maybe a little bit too cozy a relationship with business groups in terms of surveying Americans. Talk about InfraGuard.
Okay, well, that was a story in last year's book, and that was what Matt Rothschild wrote about in the Progressive magazine. InfraGuard is a network of business owners and CEOs across the country, thousands of them, who work closely with their local FBI offices to inform, using their own networks of contacts with American people and business contacts, to inform the FBI of suspicious activities. So they're a network of spies, literally. And in return, they are supposedly going to get inside information on potential terrorist threats and issues that are going on inside government. Matt, it was amazing because he writes this story, talks about InfraGuard. They have a website, yet the FBI says, oh, no, there's no collusion. We're not doing anything wrong. And nobody else in the country will talk about this. I mean, this is really close business cooperation and interlocking with the highest federal law enforcement officials in a very private way.
And what's the problem with that? Why, yeah, maybe it's cheaper to contract it out.
Well, what the problem is that it's done secretively. You don't know who's being informed on who. They're using private ownership information. So if you're doing business with a local business person in some capacity, it could be someone came and painted your house, and they in turn think that they don't like you, or they think you look strange, or that you're, you know, a Muslim who's doing prayers during the day, and then they inform on you. That's a violation of your privacy. It's a violation of your personal rights.
And I should tell our listeners, I'm talking with Peter Phillips. He's one of the editors of the, would this be now the 34th?
Well, it's my 13th book. And Carl Jensen, who was the founder of Project Censor, did it for 20 years. So we are in our 34th year right now.
That's phenomenal. Project Censor, 2010. And I should say that I got that last one, the story about InfraGuard, off the website, which you can go to at projectcensor.org, and we will have a link to that. So you can read last year's stories. This year's stories will knock your socks off, too. Now, some of
you know,
them...
You mentioned how sometimes the media will cover a story, and then we only see partial of it. And when you started to talk about story number three, our story number three this year is about the Somali pirates.
Yes, that was really fascinating as well. So why don't you tell us in brief what that story is?
It's quite a story. I mean, because the international community has come out in force to condemn and declare war on the Somali fishermen pirates, while at the same time protecting illegal, unreported, unregulated fleets they call IUU fleets from around the world, have been poaching fish and dumping toxic waste in Somalis' waters for two decades. So the Somalis are fighting back. They're saying, we don't want 800 fishing vessels in our waters, which was the number that peaked in 2005, taking advantage of Somalis' inability to have their own police force because their government collapsed. And there's been toxic dumping there that's been going on for two decades. And it was all stirred up by the tsunami in 2004. And containers of heavy metals, radioactive waste, cadmium, mercury, washed ashore. Hundreds of residents took ill. They've been abnormal, you know, bleeding, skin infection, other ailments, birth defects. The Somali, quote, pirates are really seen as, by the Somali people, as a Coast Guard, and strongly supported.
And we should say that fishing is the absolute basis of their economy.
Well, that's one of their primary means of eating. And they've been poaching hundreds of tons of fish out of their waters by these illegal fishing boats. And they've said enough. And in that process, some of them have captured ships and asked for ransom, but which nobody can support. But the origins of who they are and what they're doing come from a strong abuse by foreign powers.
And talking about toxic dumping, a story that was complete news to me and a really frightening one was about nuclear waste pools in North Carolina. Tell us about that.
Jeff Lee St. Clair did that with Counterpunch, and my students were just shocked when they read this story. You know, one of the most lethal patches of ground in North America is in North Carolina near the Sharon Harris Nuclear Power Plant owned by Progress Energy. This plant contains the largest radioactive waste storage pools in the country. So this isn't just a nuclear generating place. It's a repository for radioactive spent fuel rods from other nuclear power plants. And these rods are transported in by rail, stored in densely packed pools filled with circulating cold water to keep the waste from heating. Not only has Department of Homeland Security marked it as one of the most vulnerable terrorist targets in the nation, but should the cooling system malfunction, the resulting fire would be unquenchable and could trigger a nuclear meltdown that could reach throughout North Carolina and the entire region, imperiling millions of people's lives.
And it could be even a lot worse than Chernobyl, which in fact affected the world.
It could be incredibly huge, yes, yes. And all this is cold water keeping this going. If that failed, and indeed their warning systems have failed 15 times since 1987, MIT and Princeton pinpointed the waste pools as the biggest risk at the plant. And the Department of Energy, the study recommended that inexpensive fixes could happen, you know, that even $5 million could be spent, but progress seems unwilling to do that.
I wanted to move to another environmental issue, possibly an even greater danger to all of us, and that's climate change. You had a very interesting expose on the World Bank and carbon policy, and we're moving now into a time where the Senate is just beginning to consider climate change regulation, and of course the House has passed the Waxman-Markey bill. These are looking at a system of cap and trade. Maybe briefly just say what cap and trade is, and then what is the problem with the World Bank's carbon policy?
Well, the World Bank is brokering carbon emission trading agreements that really destroy indigenous farmlands around the world. And this effort to coordinate global action to reduce greenhouse gases began with the Kyoto Protocol in 97, now ratified by 183 nations. But many of the strategies have fatal flaws, and this clean mechanism investment by which industry can avoid reducing their own emissions through emissions reduction projects in developing nations actually means that they can go in and do new things where they're taking over land and pushing out indigenous farmers.
If their emissions are greater than a certain amount, they can basically pay.
Get away with doing it and continuing to do it, exactly.
Right, they can pay other countries to supposedly then match their excess by reductions on their part. Explain CDMs and also the forest offsets. These are two areas in which the World Bank is, in which you critique the World Bank for its carbon policy.
Well, CDMs are called Clean Development Mechanism Investment. So if you go in and invest in land, and there's been 4,000 plus approved projects where you go in and invest in land, and this can be indigenous farmland, and engage in a project that's non-polluting, then that can give you a depletion allowance to so you can continue to pollute in other parts of the world.
So it means that basically they can come in and take farmers' land?
Well, if their country allows them, but they have, you know, some incredibly amount of wealth, so they can continue, they can offer amounts of money that, you know, can take over indigenous land, and then they can go in to do wood and pulp industries, have shown great interest in harmony, this market to justify finance projects, taking over land, grazing land for enormous monospecific plantations, you know, so you can put in plantations of eucalyptus trees.
And then you can become
a part of the bank's mission, but there's a downside to this, that where hundreds of thousands of acres are diverted from, and water diverted from local streams, and have long-term environmental impacts.
So they're basically going to be taking, say, indigenous farmland and then putting up plantations, tree plantations, as a way of carbon offsets.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. What is the problem with monoculture, with tree plantations, as opposed to forests?
Well, it wipes out everything that's there, literally. So if you have indigenous medicinal plants, you've got you push plants and animals into extinction. When you totally take out a jungle or, you know, what had been pasture land, natural pasture land, and turn it into a tree forest, a monoculture tree forest, you run into, you completely impact the environmental system.
Our guest is Peter Phillips of Project Censored. We're talking about some of the most important news stories of 2009 you never heard of. There was a report today in the AP Wire about how a voter protection advocacy group is protesting, is bringing suit to the federal government against the fact that Diebold, you know, Diebold, which is the touchscreen voting machine company, was just bought by Election Systems and Software. They're claiming that this is monopolization. It violates antitrust. You have a story in Project Censored 2010 about the mysterious death of Mike Connell. He worked for Karl Rove, and he was intimately connected with the Diebold election machines, or at least some possibly dirty tricks around that, or at least he knew something about it.
Well, he certainly did. He was giving testimony that, or was available to give testimonies, facing subpoena connections in regards to 2004 election fraud in Ohio. And he died in a mysterious plane crash in 2008 before he could completely testify. He was a long-standing pilot, and he was also pretty good with computer systems and how that votes could be flipped inside these computer machines. So, and he was going to testify, and he died. His plane crashed.
And who was he? How? What did he do for Karl Rove?
Well, he was a key witness in the King Lincoln Bronzeville Neighborhood Association versus Blackwell case that was filed in 2006. And he had been chief information technology consultant to the Bush administration, working directly with Karl Rove.
And Blackwell, Kenneth Blackwell, was, of course, the election chief in Ohio at that time,
yep,
Republican.
Yep.
And Diebold, in fact, was the company that was supplying those machines there.
Well, yeah, machines all over the country failed then.
Mm-hmm.
We have an earlier story in 2 years back about the 2004 election. I mean, the exit polls in 2004 show that 9 million votes are different from the exit polls than from the actual end results that went through the counting in each state. But 37 states, the exit polls match. So this is only in 13 states, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, Nevada, California. Some of these states were ones that Kerry won, but he won by much smaller margins. And so Bush ended up winning the election by 3 million votes on the official vote count, but the exit polls show that Kerry won by 6 million.
Wow.
So there was clearly fraud in the 2004 election. Now, whether it was vote flipping or other things were involved, we really don't know. But here was one man, Mike Connell, who was worked directly with Karl Rove, and Mark Crispin Miller just says his death is highly suspicious, and that that he's just thinks that the timing and circumstances between deposition and trial are too suspicious and convenient for Rove and the Bush administration not to merit a thorough investigation. Brad Freeman was one of the authors on this. Mark Crispin Miller has certainly been involved in this for a long time. Brad did a whole chapter in our book this year on the 2008 election where he thinks there was some suspicious activity as well. So this is an ongoing issue, whether or not these voting machines are safe for democracy and whether our votes are really being counted in an accurate way.
And we've actually talked to Mark Crispin Miller about the 2004 election on this show.
Mm-hmm.
Then you take a story about Stephen E. Jones. Actually, I believe this is an updated story that was in a previous Project Censored. Tell us who Stephen E. Jones is and what his claims are. And this is about 9/11. And I have to say, you know, a lot of people call the so-called 9/11 truthers. They come in for a lot of scorn as conspiracy theorists. So tell us about this story and your take on it.
Nobody has any conspiracy theories. I mean, certainly Stephen Jones doesn't, nor do we. What we've got is factual evidence of, you know, contradictions to the government's 9/11 commission report. And Stephen Jones has been one of he's a physicist, formerly with Brigham Young University, who was the first to seriously bring forth physics questions regarding the collapse of Building 7 on 9/11. Now, Building 7 was a 47-story steel frame building that collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon after the towers, after Tower 1 and 2 had collapsed. Building 7 was not hit by an airplane. It was hit with a little bit of debris from Tower 1, and it had a fire in it. But steel frame buildings never fall down from fires. Carbon fire simply can't bring a building down. Yet this building collapsed as if all its steel pillars, all 46 interior steel pillars, failed simultaneously. So it collapsed at free fall speed in 6.5 seconds. Now, a 47-story building, that's a pretty big building. That's bigger than most buildings in most cities in the country. It was small compared to the World Trade Center, but it's a big building. And for it to collapse at free fall speed from a fire is as Jones says, just impossible. It just doesn't happen. And there's now over 700 architects and engineers who agree with him. And there's a whole community of architects organized by a fellow named Richard Gage, who lives in California, who go around the country saying that this is impossible. This building did not collapse from fires. It had to be what they call controlled demolition is the best alternative hypothesis. Now, Jones and a team of chemistry and physicists took five samples from five different locations of the dust from the World Trade Center, the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. And they did spectrum analysis, they did full X-ray spectroscopy and scanning, and what they found were these tiny nano red chip material. And an examination of these red chips show that it is unreacted thermite, which is thermite is an aluminum oxide compound with other metals in it, which is used when burned in buildings is a demolition technique, a private tactic that will melt steel instantly because it burns so hot. Now, they don't have any theories of you know, conspiracies here. They just simply have found thermite in the dust from the World Trade Center and have published those results in a peer-reviewed chemistry journal called Open Chemistry from Denmark. You know, so the question becomes, what's thermite doing in our dust from the World Trade Center? And that's a big question right now, and it's certainly not being written about in the corporate media. They like to label hard-hitting questions like this as conspiracy theories and ignore them.
Well, yeah, so you actually tackle this idea of conspiracy theories because Project Censored has been called, I think, a left-wing conspiracy-oriented organization. Are you a left-wing conspiracy-oriented organization, and how do you answer the whole the charges of conspiracy theories that are so often put forth to counter these kinds of stories?
Well, it's easy to label somebody, you know, with you're a conspiracy theory, or you're a nutcase, or you're a tinfoil hat, or whatever you do. But you know, conspiracies happen all the time by small groups of people. I mean, any corporate board of directors meets in closed rooms about how to best to maximize their profits. Now, if they do this by violating laws, undermining ethics, showing favoritism to friends, or they're involved in a conspiracy. And there's microplots all the time around the world of people conspiring to take advantage of different things. So, of course, conspiracies happen. In fact, the government's theory about how 9/11 happened is a conspiracy theory. Now, when facts get in the place of these, such as how did the World Trade Centers fall down so quickly, and why did Building 7 collapse, then instead of addressing the science of these issues, we divert, you know, the media in this case, but also the government, diverts attention from the facts and starts labeling people, you know, or red-baiting them, or on attacks on the individuals, or straw-person distractions, or creating false dilemmas that kind of undermine legitimate investigations. And that's where I think it's so very important that universities, and like the Open Chemical Physics Journal that was published in Denmark, is a peer-reviewed scientific journal that says there was thermite in the samples from the dust of the World Trade Centers. That's pretty hard to contradict, I mean, unless you do additional studies and address it. But ignoring that is most inappropriate. And simply labeling somebody that addresses these issues, no matter what the consequences are, or the questions that result from that, is highly problematic. We pride ourselves in looking at the scientific facts of stories. We have faculty that will verify these stories before we publish them and support. And we're not doing the stories in themselves. We're just validating the stories are true. Now, whether or not that's left-wing, that's a whole other ball game. We tend to think that covering stories about the powerful is what journalism is supposed to do. It's not left-wing or right-wing or anything. It's just, you know, what are the powerful doing and why, you know, why are they doing it? Who wins? And as we look at this and to verify that, we actually went back and compared our stories during the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, and we were taking Clinton on equal status to Bush. So in terms of are we left-leaning, absolutely not.
And at least you're bipartisan in that case.
Definitely.
Well, Peter Phillips, this is a fascinating book. This one is the 2010 edition of Project Censored. There are many, many very important stories that we didn't even touch on. Also, there are not just stories that are censored, but also an examination of the news and how it functions, and as well some good news stories about how things are being covered more than have been covered in the past. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, and encourage people to go to our website at www.projectcensored.org. You can order the Censored 2010 book there, and it'll be shipped to you. That helps support the project when you do it that way.
Wonderful. Thanks again.
Okay.
Peter Phillips of Project Censored. You can read the top 25 censored stories for 2010 by going to writersvoice.net for the links or directly to projectcensored.org. Next up, novelist Dan Schoen. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Dan Schoen's novel, Await Your Reply, opens with a shocker. A young man who's being rushed to the hospital with his severed hand next to him in a cooler. He's with his father, or at least someone who claims to be his father. And his dad isn't the only character whose identity is in doubt. The novel is all about identity, shifting identities, reinventing oneself, finding out one's own identity, and identity theft. It follows three apparently separate stories, bringing them together only in the end. And if genre is a literary version of identity, Schoen's book itself has multiple personalities, moving from philosophical speculation to thriller with shape-shifting ease. Dan Schoen is adopted, and so thinking about what makes us who we are, nature or nurture, is rooted in his own life. I asked him what identity means to him.
In some ways, my concept of identity is very conservative. I think that we draw our identity from place and from family and from a continuity with the people who know us and can identify us in the world, and that it begins to loosen and slip out of our control when we're in a place where no one knows us, where we're alienated, where we're lost. And I think that, you know, I mean, I guess that's basically a very Norman Rockwell vision, even though the book is nowhere near a Norman Rockwell book.
As you can hear right there, we began having some problems with Dan Schoen's phone. So we stopped the interview and started again when he went to a different one.
That in, you know, even though the novel itself is nowhere near like a Norman Rockwell vision, I think at the heart it has that, the sort of flip side of what I'm talking about, which is that in order to be a whole person, you really need other people, you need family, you need friends, you need community, and that the loss of identity often has to do with alienation, aloneness, and an inability to trust other people.
So you're really saying that actually our identity of ourselves depends on our relationships to others.
Oh, well, I think absolutely. In some ways, if no one knows you, then you're no one.
So let's go back now to the book itself. I mean, this is a thriller. This is a mystery novel in a way, as well as a discourse on identity. So we don't want to give too many things away. And if I tread a little bit too close to the edge on that, I'm sure you'll let me know.
Sure.
Okay. The book is really three stories, the stories of three different stories, which are separate until it begins to dawn on the reader. And I think for me, it was about two-thirds of the way through, that they're actually connected. These stories are connected.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you outline who the people are? There's Miles Cheshire. Tell us who he is and what's his identity in life.
Okay, well, I've got three sets of characters. Miles is in his 30s, and for the last 10 or 15 years, he's been looking for his identical twin brother, who has been diagnosed with schizophrenia and has been on the lam for the last 10 or 15 years, always just a little bit out of reach, although he, at the same time, has for that period been contacting Miles with letters, emails, phone calls that always keep Miles looking for him. So they've been engaged in this kind of cat and mouse game. And when the novel opens, Miles is on his way to the Arctic, where he believes that his brother Hayden is now living.
And this is almost like this is like one of those Russian puppets that you keep on opening, and you see something else inside. I mean, the very idea of having these characters be twins is says something about identity.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess I was really fascinated by the concept of twins, even though I'm not a twin. I've been interested in it since I was young. I grew up in a small town in Nebraska without any other kids my age. And so I had this fantasy that that it would be great to have an identical twin, someone who, you know, was exactly like you and you would have this deep connection to, and that you would share everything with. And as it turns out in my novel, it's not a dream come true after all.
Especially in this case, because
right.
Because this brother is, well, at least he's been diagnosed as schizophrenic, which is another play on identity. The old idea of schizophrenic was somebody with multiple selves.
Right. And the diagnosis itself is, in the novel, is somewhat suspect, at least to Miles. He's not sure whether his brother is really schizophrenic or whether he just fooled their high school psychologists into believing that he was.
And he's, in some way, his identity is very tied up with finding his brother.
Yes. In fact, he's been so obsessed with it that he's had a hard time getting on with his life. And every time he tries to sort of force himself to settle down, to get a job, to become, you know, focused on his own concerns, his brother contacts him, and he's back once again looking for the brother, trying to save his brother.
Now, I want to ask you about these characters as they unfold. Miles and, his brother really doesn't unfold as a character except in the mind of other people, or at least
right.
not until possibly the end of the book.
Right.
And even there, I wasn't sure. So did this unfold for you as well as you were writing this book, or is this something that kind of sprang full-blown from your mind?
No, it really developed as I was going through the first draft. And as you said, there's a lot of twists and turns that you don't want to give away over the course of the book. But the surprises that happened for the reader also happened for me as I was writing the book. And I didn't really outline it. I guess one of the things for me about outlines is there's a kind of predeterminism about them. And it's easier for me to write when I don't know what's going to happen. It gives the characters and the situations an openness that I find exciting.
And I have to say, this was a real page turner. This is a book you keep on wanting to know what's next.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Lucy Lattimore is the next character. She's doing something else, which is a very American kind of thing to do. She's trying to reinvent herself. Tell us who she is.
Okay, Lucy is growing up in a small town in Ohio, and her parents were killed in a car accident, so she's living with her older sister. They're very poor, and she really dreams of a life of sort of glamour and riches, and she becomes involved with her high school history teacher, who promises that he is going to take her away from the small town life and that they're going to travel and have great adventures together. And so she decides that she's going to run off with him, and his ideas sound like they may or may not be somewhat criminal in intent. She's of age, she's 18, but she's still pretty naive about what lies in wait out for her in the big world.
We're talking with novelist Dan Schoen about his latest book, Await Your Reply. He's also the author of You Remind Me of Me and other novels. If it's okay, I'd like to read a little passage from the book. This is on page 220, and it's very short, so I'll just read it myself. There is a point at which she and her high school teacher take on new identities.
Right.
And he's speaking to her here. He says, it's difficult at first making the switch. There's a bump you have to get past. You get used to one mode and one persona, and there can be some cognitive dissonance when you transfer over. So talk a little bit about this transition. Is this something, I mean, you said before that this is, you know, these characters are not the normal Norman Rockwell type of folks. You know, they do question their identity. They're changing it all the time. Is that what it's about? It's just a question of switch because they're pretending, or is there something behind that switch? I mean, even Lucy says a little bit later on, she says, you know, is there a soul that's really peering out from these eyes?
Right. Well, I mean, I guess one of the big questions for me is whether the self is just a personality or a persona, as George Orson suggests, that, you know, you can be any number of different people, or whether there is something essential about each individual person that's unchangeable, that is this core that's really us. You know, we use these terms all the time. He knows the real me, or she's changed, she's a different person now. And what we mean by that is really complicated, and I guess part of the theme in the novel is trying to unravel what that stuff means. What is the real me? What does it mean when someone changes? And I guess whether or not I get to the answer, I don't know, but it was a fun thing to think about.
You're a parent, is that right?
Yes, I am. I have two teenage boys.
So when they were born, did you have a sense that they had and I won't say personality, I'll say an identity?
Yes. I think that almost from the very beginning, there were certain elements of their personality that were there and were unchanged in some way from, like, birth all the way through. Other things, you know, like I have a teenager who has gone through, you know, like a different persona every year, it seems like. You know, he went from, you know, the lacrosse player to the, you know, goth teen with dyed hair and piercings to now he's in the mode of the sort of artsy hipster. So but, you know, it's like each time, if you would have dared to call such a, you know, something like that a persona, he would have been deeply insulted. You know what I mean?
Yes, and in fact, you know, it's seen as normal for teenagers to try on different identities.
Right, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And then there's Ryan Schuyler, who is a teenager himself.
Right. I think he's almost 20.
Oh, that's right. And he's a college student.
Yes.
Now, tell us a little bit about him and his story. We started out with him with the
he's
hand.
He's the guy of the severed hand, and his story is that he's had a tough time in high school. His parents were very determined that he would have a super successful life, and so he's managed to get into Northwestern, and he's struggling there. And when he finds out that his parents are not actually his parents, they are his aunt and uncle, and he's been adopted, and the person who is his father is a guy who he thought all his life was his uncle. Boy, that's a mouthful. Did that make any sense at all?
Oh yeah, it absolutely did.
All right. So anyway, he finds out that he was adopted, but his parents didn't tell him. His father is his uncle, and his father contacts him to tell him all this and to invite him to join in basically some sort of shady dealings that have to do with credit card scams. And Ryan decides that he would rather do this with his father than continue on as a student at Northwestern, where he feels like a fake and a failure. So in some ways, he's abandoning this life that has been prepared for him by his parents and taking on this life that would be completely repulsive to them. And I guess, as a parent of a teenager, I know how attractive that is. And having been a teenager myself, how attractive it is to take on a life that would completely shock and disappoint your parents.
Right. In fact, Ryan is kind of going through something that is typical, as you say, of many teenagers, and yet most teenagers don't get to do what he did, so they get to learn that their identity, they get to solidify their identity a little bit better within the confines of how it's been all along, whereas he chooses a radically different path.
Right.
One that, in fact, involves identity theft.
Right. And, I think that the interesting thing to me about the characters, all the characters in the book, but particularly Ryan, is that, they make choices that are based on snap decisions in a lot of ways, and then they find themselves in situations in which they can't really turn back.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I'd like to ask you a personal question, and I know for, many, if not most, writers, what they write doesn't have to do with their own personal life, but you also were adopted, like your character Ryan.
Right.
How did that impact your own sense of identity?
I think it's a major part of my life, and it's something that I find myself writing about in one way or another. And I guess part of it has to do with the idea that was very upfront when I was growing up, which is that I could have had a number of different lives. Everybody is aware of that, but I think to me the concept was much more direct, because in fact I could have been adopted by any number of people, and it also so happened, I guess, that the life that I chose was fairly radically different from the life that I grew up with. I mean, my dad was a construction worker. I grew up in rural Nebraska, and I went on to to go to college, which neither of my parents did. Actually, nobody in my family besides me went to college, and I became a college professor. I married someone who was Jewish, and nobody in my family had ever met a Jew before. So, then I live in kind of a suburban community that's really radically different from where I grew up. And so I myself went through all these transformations, and it's not just the issue of adoption. It's the issue of the kinds of changes that have emerged over the course of my life that have made me particularly aware of that issue of identity and how we become different people.
And so there is this there's this tension between the idea of identity as something that even you said you saw, and I certainly saw when my son was born, something that seemed core, and something else that seems much more malleable.
Right, right. And what is that core thing? I mean, and is that immutable? In some ways, as a parent, you think, wow, there's that thing that you can't snuff out. And yet, as a teenager, a lot of times the dream is to snuff out that very thing that your parents think is the core of you. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I wondered at a certain point if this book was almost the end point of, or one point of the arc of the Western notions of identity. You know, Michel de Montaigne, back in the 16th century, he wrote, "I am myself the matter of my book." You know, he is credited with being the first, you know, Western writer to really put himself, to write about himself.
Right.
And your characters aren't really clear whether there's a fixed self or not. It's almost, you're going from the modern, which is Montaigne, is seen as the first modern writer in some way, to the postmodern.
Right, right, and to sort of post-structuralism as well, which I think, you know, is a kind of fancy literary criticism idea that is now fairly mainstream, which is that the way that we construct our identity is often just made up of stories and things that we're telling ourselves, and it's not entirely real. I mean, there's a lot of research that's been coming out about memory and the way that the memory works, and one of the things that researchers are finding is that much of what those very vivid flashes of memory are actually imagination that's filling in a lot of what we think we remember. So in a very real sense, there's not a lot of difference between a memory and a daydream.
Yeah, and that's something that your character, Miles, really struggles with in trying to figure out whether the things that his brother claims happened in their childhood actually happened or not.
Yeah. Yeah, because the brother makes some fairly outrageous claims about what happened to them when they were kids.
We're talking with Dan Schoen about his latest novel, Await Your Reply. It's a thriller that explores the theme of identity. Now, there's the other aspect of this novel is the mystery aspect of it, and it's a pretty other than that beginning, which is pretty gruesome. I wouldn't say most of it is gruesome, but there is a kind of very creepy aspect to it. You have a gothic house that's there, and you've said someplace that this is something you loved when you were a kid. You loved reading, H.P. Lovecraft and other kind of horror stories.
Right, right. I mean, I loved particularly the kind of, I guess the kind of suspense thriller books that, you know, that you find with, say, Shirley Jackson and Daphne du Maurier. I love those kinds of books, the books that had a lot of atmosphere and they were ominous without necessarily being particularly bloody. I mean, despite the severed hand in the beginning, this is not a particularly bloody book either. It's more about atmosphere and sort of dread than it is about dismemberment.
Can I say that I actually found that it had a happy ending?
I'm glad that you did. I like to think that for at least some of the characters, things turn out happy.
Yeah, they do. Now, I have one last question I wanted to ask you, and this is... there's a recurrent theme of Fibonacci numbers, and I had to look it up on Wikipedia, which my eyes glazed over after the first paragraph. So tell us, what are Fibonacci numbers and what's their significance in this book? Why do you mention them so often?
It's a really good question. I came across Fibonacci numbers from a website that was about conspiracy theories. And one of the main characters, Hayden, is particularly taken with various kinds of conspiracy theories. And the Fibonacci numbers are a set of numbers that are used to particularly predict different kinds of population increase. The Fibonacci rabbits are the rabbits that take over the island. There's one rabbit, and then there's three rabbits, and then there's five, and so on and so forth. And the Fibonacci numbers tell you, like, where the tipping point comes in the population explosion of the rabbits. I guess that's one of the uses of those numbers. Although, like a lot of numbers that reach up into infinity, they've been given sort of mystical significance in the popular imagination, so that, you know, like the golden mean or the golden ratio, they're numbers that have been given maybe a sort of quasi psychic quality to them, like you can use them to predict the end of the world or whatever. I was playing around with a lot of those kinds of things because they were things that Hayden was really drawn to. I subscribed to this magazine called The Fortean Times, which is all about the weird and unusual, and has a lot of conspiracy theory and UFOs and Bigfoot and, you know, mysterious deaths and so on and so forth. And a lot of the stuff that I put in there came directly from The Fortean Times.
The Fortean Times.
Yes, F-O-R-T-E-A-N. Fortean.
Huh. And so what does the role of conspiracy as a theme play in the book? I mean, this character, Hayden, is a conspiracy theorist. You know, it just struck me as you were talking that, well, with conspiracies, you don't know what's true and what's not either.
Right. Right. I mean, I guess the thing that's attractive about conspiracy is that it does create this sense that the world is not as knowable as we'd like to think. And, you know, that's one of the beautiful attractions of cryptozoology, which suggests that we still may have animals out there that we haven't discovered. The chupacabra may really exist. The chupacabra?
What is that?
Oh, it's sort of like a Mexican myth. It's like a cross between a coyote and a vampire. Chupa means goat, and cabra means, no wait, chupa means sucking, and cabra means goat. So it's basically a goat sucker. it's an animal that's sort of that's believed to, like, come in the night and suck the blood from the goats, and sometimes attacks humans. It's like the Mexican version of Bigfoot or something like that. Mm. I guess the concept of the undiscovered or the stuff that may be out there that we have no way of really identifying is really attractive to a lot of people, and I think that it's attractive to these characters too.
The mystery of life and of identity.
Yes.
Well, Dan Schoen, your wonderful novel is Await Your Reply. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you.
Dan Schoen is also the author of You Remind Me of Me, Among the Missing, and Fitting Ends. We talked to him about his latest book, Await Your Reply. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.